Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
They're celebrating their society. They're celebrating their power to say no and to tell the government that, you know, democracy doesn't mean we elect a dictator for 4 years and he can tell us any goddamn thing he wants over the next 4 years and ram it down our throats. That's not their conception of democracy, and it's not a modern conception of democracy. They're saying we as a collective of youth, a large collective of youth in the post-secondary system, must have a say about the cost of that service, the cost of that provision.
That's the voice of journalist and broadcaster Charles Borland. On this week's show, we speak to Charles about the ongoing student protest in Montreal, the government's brutal repression of that protest, and the correlation between that protest and the CP Rail workers losing their rights. So stay tuned.
Someone who has reminded us that it's time to rise up for several years now is Charles Borland. He's a journalist here in Vancouver, the host and producer of Wake Up with Co-op for many years, and now his regular show discussions on Wednesday evenings on Co-op Radio. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us, Charles.
So it's a delight to be with you again.
I want to talk to you about, you know, what is happening here in Canada, because I think it's worth a celebration. The way the students are rising up against the Charette government's very heavy-handed Bill 78 in Quebec, is cause for celebration. And I wonder if we could start there, because as a society, we need to think about what this means for us in terms of allowing these types of bills that the limit not just our freedom of movement, but also that declare public spaces as being off limit to the public. Can you talk a little bit about your insights?
My
on
perception
this?
Of that, sure. Well, listen, Sylvia. First of all, you know, the masses in Quebec are celebrating in a oppositional state of mind. They're celebrating with protests right around Quebec. They have this casserole movement where they take up this tradition of banging pots and pans. Somebody told me that it's part of the Chilean political resistance movement, but whatever, it has certainly been taken up by the people of Quebec. And now right across Canada, I've seen reports showing people banging pots and marching through the streets from Hamilton and Toronto and various other parts. And I think there may have even been something in Vancouver. I may have missed it, but I do remember people talking about there going to be a casserole in our city. The point, Sylvia, you make is quite true, that this is a real attack on public space. It's an attack on human rights. The human rights movement now has to really focus on what's going on with this neoliberal agenda assault on it through the Harper dictatorship, through the Charette dictatorship, through the government here in BC, and so on. The students' demand is so simple and clear, Sylvia. It's just a straightforward demand that post-secondary education for the young people of their nation should be affordable. In 1960s, there was what they called the Perron Commission. I was around at the time when it was published, and I actually remember it quite well because it created a broad discussion across Canada about post-secondary education. And in BC, there was the McDonald Report, which was promising to build colleges that would be affordable to the students in BC. And the Perron Commission actually proposed at the time that there should be free tuition at the post-secondary level. It had quite a kind of a prophetic vision about society. It said, in a modern society, to open the way for knowledge to be passed on from one generation to the next and to create new knowledge, to provide education to all the youth to the largest degree possible, was an essential feature of the society. Now, it's been, you know, over 40 years since the Perron Report was published, but the students have not forgotten it, and the parents and the grandparents have not forgotten it, because the people of Quebec, like the people in British Columbia and across Canada, know that to make headway, the youth need a good quality public education, and it needs to be financed by the society as a whole. Now, the struggle is so just, it's so simple, it's so straightforward, that Charest really has made a monkey of himself. He really is a laughable, childish, foolish man to go through all kinds of maneuvers and hoops and twists and turns to say that, oh, the demand of the students is ridiculous. They have to pay. It only costs 50 cents a day. Only costs 50 cents a day. Sylvia, first of all, it costs more than 50 cents a day if he did his arithmetic correctly. But even if he were only to cost the students 50 cents a day, do you know what it would mean to the banks for the average student loans in Quebec, which are now about $14,000 for a student graduating, which is lower than the rest of Canada? It would mean another $100 million interest in the five banks of Quebec that are legalized to give students their loans, that are authorized to give student loans. So it's a straightforward handout of the Charest government to the rich and powerful to hand over $100 million of future students' interest payments on loans that would be incurred if they had to carry this additional tuition weight on their shoulders. So it's a really big issue for the people of Quebec. It's a really big issue for the people of Quebec, and it's really important that the people have shown the spunk they have shown in Quebec, not only to support the students, because there was division in the society over that, but especially when the Charest government went through his latest monkey acrobats and he passed this damnable, I would call it really a repressive, you could even say fascistic law, that Bill 78.
I just wanted to add that, you know, before I when we started the show, with speaking to Mateo in Spain, one of the students in Spain. And the point he made was that, you know, in Spain, they're increasing the tuition rate 66%. And I was thinking about this, you know what I mean? It's not the amount, right? But it's the principle. It's because once we, if it's 300, next year is 500, the following year is, you know, 2,000 or whatever it is. But it says the principle that education is something that we need to purchase, that we as students need to pay for, because it is no longer valued as a good to society. It is no longer valued as what was presented on those reports you just spoken about, you know, a way for society to evolve, to transfer, to share knowledge, right? And to grow as a society. So it, to me, it's a principle stance. But I wanted to argue that, you know, at the same time that we are told education should be something we must purchase for and pay for, we are seeing the value that is supposed to come from education, primarily in a capitalist society, a job, right? We're no longer being educated to be better citizens or to be better people, but rather to have jobs. And so at the other end, you know what I mean, the jobs that are being promoted are not being valued as well. So it becomes, to me, when we privatize education, when we privatize post-secondary, it becomes a policy of entrenching privilege in the hands of very few people, and, you know, all others may participate if they can afford it.
Yeah, Sylvia, you raise very, very important points here. Very important points people need to reflect on. First of all, we have to state the shameful fact of British Columbia's situation. Students in the post-secondary system in British Columbia today, believe it or not, pay more than 50% of the cost of post-secondary education. The student's tuition fee is greater contribution to the financing of public education in British Columbia than the entire government's contribution. So you can see the shift very graphically in that fact. Now, what you point out about the necessity of a modern society advancing itself through perpetuating the knowledge, passing it on from one generation to another, and expanding it, the contribution of knowledge through the work of the students, the graduate students, and so on and so forth, that is being attacked. And so what this point you're saying about privilege and elitism and so on, it actually is hearkening us back to the Middle Ages. It's hearkening us back to feudalism. And it has, and also speaking about the content of the education, the way they want to crimp it and mold it and force it in a particular way, it reminds one of the priests of old in the medieval times, the pre-French Revolutionary times, when they had a very narrow education base, and it was elitist, and it was for the reserve of the rich, and so on and so forth. And also it had this very narrow content. So we need to really reflect that to be a modern society. It will hurt Canada. It will hurt the whole world if this neoliberal agenda of the giant monopolies, of this mentality that there is no society, as Margaret Thatcher preached, there's no society, she said. There's just a marketplace. Get used to it. And so, of course, it was an attack on the very notion that we are living in a social economy. Nobody's individual work can make a modern car or a modern house or provide the services and run a hospital, run an educational system. It's all collective work. It's all social work. It's modern. We're not in a Middle Ages economy. And so we need, as a society, to ensure that each generation has this provision of public education, similarly for public health, similarly for looking after our aged people and so on. All of these are matters facing the society and require a social responsibility, a social input. So what the students are doing, and it's very interesting too, Sylvia, the point you're making about making this a kind of commodity, and that's what the students in Quebec talk about very broadly in their discourse. They point out that they're not only fighting for their lower tuitions and freezing the tuitions and even pushing them down and providing society with an education for the youth. They also speak about the commodification of education and that they're opposed to that commodification of education. They want the youth to be participants in a society, and they want them to, when they graduate, to then contribute to the society, to provide wealth that is goes on to look after the old people, for example, to provide for the health care, for example. So this is all part and parcel of the discourse that is taking place throughout Quebec as a result of the students' resistance. And as you said at the very opening, it is celebratory because they're celebrating their society. They're celebrating their power to say no and to tell the government that, you know, democracy doesn't mean we elect a dictator for 4 years and he can tell us any goddamn thing he wants over the next 4 years and ram it down our throats. That's not their conception of democracy, and it's not a modern conception of democracy. They're saying we, as a collective of youth, a large collective of youth in the post-secondary system, must have a say about the cost of that service, the cost of that provision. Now, there are lots of people who yap in the rest of Canada. They say, oh, these Quebec students, what's the word they use, Sylvia, for saying you've got a privileged position, you're the something-something generation, you know, you've got this, I forget the word that slips off my mind, but, you know, it's like you have an established right, you know, and so you shouldn't...
Self-entitlement.
Hey?
They keep saying we're self-entitled or something.
Entitlement. Thank you. That's the word, entitlement. Well, let me switch subjects here a little bit. Entitlement. Let's talk about entitlement. They're saying the students aren't entitled to that low-cost education. But the former CEO of Canadian Pacific Railway, the workers who make it profitable every year, who have just been criminalized for going on strike to resist having a 12-hour workday, their former CEO was apparently entitled to an $18 million golden handshake to retire in the coup d'etat against his board of directors, and, in addition to that, a $2 million a year pension. So the workers are told, hey, you can't be entitled to this defined benefit pension scheme that you've got. The new generation are going to have that taken away from them. And you can't be entitled to having a 10-hour workday. You need to work 12 hours a day. But the CEO is totally entitled, apparently, to have an $18 million goodbye present and a $2 million a year pension. So, you see, the notion of entitlement is very different when we're talking about workers who actually perform productive activity. Students who are learning to become productive citizens in the society, and wealthy owners of capital who just grab as much as they can of the social production and take off to heaven somewhere and live in paradise.
Well, that's an important point to make, because while Bill 78 has been the heavy-handed response against the students, it has many implications for workers, right?
Absolutely.
You know, it restricts who and when and how we get to protest or dissent against the very authoritarian decisions of governments at times, such as the imposition of a settlement by the government. If the government is interfering, what's the incentive for companies to negotiate in a fair manner with the workers?
Well, of course, the old social contract, Sylvia, that came as a result, by the way, of huge worker strike struggles at the end of World War II. First of all, the workers of the world and the people of the world had to defeat fascism, Hitler fascism. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about rights at all. We'd all be living in slave camps somewhere. But the thing is that with the victory over fascism at the end of World War II, people said, you know what, we're not going to go through the 30s type of lifestyle anymore. We're not going to go through Great Depressions. We're not going to be workers without rights. And the workers rose up across North America and in Canada, and in British Columbia here too. The woodworkers had a big strike in 1946. The steelworkers the same. And they got what they called the historic compromise, whereby the workers would agree not to down their tools and go on strike in a contract period. And the employer had to recognize the unions and negotiate collective agreements with them. And that was the quid pro quo of not organizing revolution in North America. So the deal was made. Now, that deal held up over several decades. And in that period, as everybody knows, the workers in the trade union movement, through strike struggles, through various resistance struggles, did raise the standard of living for the workers, up and through the 70s at least, and they did acquire certain things like defined benefit pensions. That happened in the 50s and 60s. And these various achievements have been passed over to the younger generations as they come up. However, today, that social contract is being thoroughly scrapped. And so governments, two things are happening. One is, companies are straightforwardly locking out workers and telling them that we're going to take away this, this, and this unless you sign a contract. That happened with a lockout in the steelworkers a couple of years back in Stelco, formerly Stelco, now U.S. Steel Corporation. It happened to the workers in formerly Inco and now Valley. Notice all the foreign takeovers in big industries in Canada, and so on and so forth. So the new generation of workers were dictated to and told that they're not going to get a defined benefit pension scheme. They have to have what is called a defined savings pension, which is nothing more than RSPs. So real setbacks have taken place, and they have taken place, just as you said, in a context where government is criminalizing the workers' trade unions' right to strike. And we saw that with the Harper government doing that against the workers in the Air Canada in a company. We saw them do that with the postal workers, and now we've seen them do that with the CPR rail workers organized by the Teamsters. In BC, we've seen the provincial government do that with Bill 22 against the BC Teachers Federation. So when they're shredding this social contract, really now there is no equilibrium between the workers and the employer. There, as you point out, why should an employer negotiate? There's no weight. There's no, in the arm wrestle, the other arm is being crippled. So it's really important that one correlates the Bill 78 attack on the students' right to demonstrate and this latest bill that just passed the federal house to negate the right of the CPR workers to strike and negotiate a contract with the CPR. And remember, they're not asking for more money, Sylvia. They're telling the company, we don't want to work a 12-hour day. And there's one thing I have to say about the CPR workers, because I just learned this in my discussion with them last week, and that is, you probably won't believe this, I certainly didn't believe it, did you know that railroad workers in the country Canada do not get a single paid sick day? They have to work 98.... The attendance discipline at CPR is 98.7%. If you're not there 98.7% of the time, you get disciplined. And I said to them, I said, well, what happens when you get sick? He says, we go to work. I said, oh, that's healthy. You're driving one of those trains, 2-mile-long trains, across 50 or 60-level crossing, and you're sick. He said, it happens all the time. He said, not only we're sick, he says, we come in and we make everybody else sick. So this is in Canada, 2012, Sylvia, and these workers are saying, you know what, we don't want to be compelled to work a compulsory 12-hour day. It's long enough to work 10. You ask me, Sylvia, it's long enough to work 8 hours driving one of those trains, to be honest. The number of deaths in railway accidents in Canada is fairly significant. And we know what happens when a train falls into a river or a lake. There's huge environmental issues, and communities are threatened if a train's carrying some poisonous gas or something. So these are very responsible, high-stress jobs. And yet, you see, the owners at CPR that give rise to a CEO can retire with a $2 million a year pension and an $18 million golden handshake. Those guys can dictate to the workers, no, extend your work day, no sick days, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's all part of the same thing, isn't it?
To me, it's a way to slowly, you know, segregate us, you know, alienate us from one another. And the more people sit comfortably and tolerate these kinds of measures, the more our own personal freedoms continues to be eroded. And soon enough, you know, the goal is to really have a country without unions, a country where you have, you know, service workers earning $6 an hour. You know, that would be possibly the ideal. But, you know, I think that we realize that most workers anyways, I think realize that we need to get together, we need to do something about it, and that this is no longer tolerable. I wonder if you could talk about the kinds of resistance and ways that people can participate, because I think it's important for us to recognize that this organization is already in place. All we need to do is plug in.
Well, yeah, and there are other features too. One ought to be conscious of. One of them is that since the Harper government has come in, the number of temporary workers, so-called temporary workers, that have been introduced into the Canadian workforce is just shot up to the sky. There's hundreds of thousands of them in Canada now, and these workers, of course, have no rights whatsoever. If they were to do anything about trade unions and whatever, they'd be turfed out by their employer. The employer has virtual control over them. And so this is a very negative contemporary feature of the labor market, so-called labor market. And so workers have a big responsibility, of course, to talk amongst themselves and to discuss amongst themselves and to be active. I think really what the Quebec students teach us more than anything, Sylvia, is the power of collective thought and action. The students have really had an exemplary behavior of meeting together, talking things over in their student assemblies, debating issues, voting democratically, participating, and then, you know, participating in a conscious way so as to set their practical work and then carrying it out collectively together. And it's really won the praise of the people of Quebec, most especially in defense of their rights to demonstrate against this Bill 78 and so on. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the fact that just the day before, the Minister of Education and Charest broke off the negotiations. And the students let it be known that they're more than willing to negotiate. In fact, they were just coming back to government with a proposal and a plan how they could save tuition fees from increasing without increasing funding into the system. The students have discussed quite deeply and broadly about how to appropriate the money that is put into secondary education in a manner that would be most wisely used for education and not just to pay high-priced administrators and various other things. There's a lot of money wasted in the system. I know we in the Post-Secondary Educators Federation here, the FPSE, we talk at our general meeting about the fact that a lot of money in BC's education system is wasted on high-paid, deans and presidents and administrators, president's assistants and so on, and vice presidents and all this sort of stuff. It's very heavily weighted at the top. And the students are cognizant of that. They have made a number of proposals, and they suggested them to the ministry, and the government simply shut the door on their face, which shows that they don't have clear conscience. They're not interested to negotiate a settlement. They're not interested to mediate it. They want to dictate to the students, and they want to let the entire Quebec society and Canada and the world know that with our so-called limited democracy that, you know, what they call the democratic government, can do and say anything it wants without successful opposition from the public. And so they're really in a mood to impose dictate. They're not in a mood to solve a problem. They're not in a mood to negotiate with an important collective in the Quebec society, which is really what democracy should be about. It should be about how individual rights, collective rights, and the needs of the society as a whole are harmonized. How can they be brought together so that the individual person has his rights, but at the same time, his or her rights, but at the same time, they can't, you know, obstruct and deny the collective rights and just charge in front of them, as certain students wanted to do by getting injunctions against their student unions and so on. So there's a lot at stake, Sylvia, both in the resistance against Bill 78, in the workers' resistance, that is very, very necessary to reflect on and to just make decisions about being active and not allowing this kind of dictatorship to subsume the society, take it over, and to reduce us into really slave labor or slave students or slaves. I mean, this is modern times. We want democracy. We want the affirmation of people's personalities. We want the affirmation of nations and peoples and cultures and languages and rights. And so I just feel that the Quebec students are really making an historic contribution to all of Canadians, and indeed around the world. Sylvia, you know, this resistance of the students is celebrated, as you use that word, celebrate. It's celebrated in New York, it's celebrated in London, it's celebrated in Paris. It has been made known around the world. And so, I think it's good that we had a chance to converse about this today.
Well, thank you so much to you, Charles, for joining us this morning. I know you have a very special event and you're making time to be part of a public dialogue that I think is very important. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Sylvia, for having me. Take care.
Take care. Bye. That was Charles Boylan. He is the producer and host of Discussions every Wednesday evening on Co-op Radio at 7 p.m.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.